I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Downtowns are coming back all over the U.S., none more strikingly than Philadelphia's Center City. As founding director of Philadelphia's Center City District, Paul Levy is the man at the helm of the revitalization of what USA Today recently called America's Next Great City. We'll talk to Paul about the turnaround he's engineered on today's Smart City. Jordan Rappaport, senior economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, is also with us. He has challenged the conventional wisdom that cities and their suburbs compete for jobs and residents. Instead, he says their fates move together. Paul Levy and Jordan Rappaport are our guests today on Smart City. Plus, Steve Goldsmith will introduce us to one of the nation's best 311 systems. We'll return right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Steve Goldsmith is director of the Innovation in American Government program at Harvard.
For those of us who've been local elected officials, there's a familiar thing that happens to you as you walk around your community, and that somebody stops and says, you know, I called in to have a hole in the street fixed or my street light repaired. Nobody ever called me back. It happens every day, every community. So how do you deal with this, particularly when you have a big city like the city of Chicago? Consolidating all those calls, making it easier for the citizen actually to reach the city hall bureaucrat, if you will, that's step one. But step two is to make sure that once the call reaches city hall that something actually happens and the citizen sees results. Well, those problems kind of attracted us to the city of Chicago. A number of cities have these 311 systems now, the civil complaint system that's equivalent to the 911 system. But what Chicago's done that's really interesting is they track that call all the way through the system for performance purposes, for citizen service purposes, for grading purposes. And stay tuned. You really think that's interesting in what Chicago's done with its 311 system.
Ted, what is the purpose of 311?
Well, the purpose of 311 on one level is to provide a gateway to all the programs and services that local government offers the citizens and the residents of the city of Chicago. By dialing 311 from landlines, from cell phones, in any area code within the city of Chicago, one is able to access all of those government programs and services offered by the city of Chicago. On another level, though, 311 is a critical tool that city department managers have come to rely on for enhancing the performance of their staff and of their respective departments, because it provides them with an ability to monitor, to measure, to analyze the work that they're doing, the work that their crews are doing. It enables them to establish benchmarks and measure themselves and monitor their performance against those benchmarks. And I guess on another level, 311 has become symbolic or emblematic of transparent, accountable government by providing an enterprise software solution to managing city work. We're enabling stakeholders to have access to that information and hold their departments accountable.
Give me an idea, Ted, of the range of requests you get at 311.
They could be very simple. On one level, the range of requests at 311 might begin with just simple information about how to access different programs or services, office hours, addresses of facilities where they might speak to a Department on Aging representative or a City Department of Human Services staff member. Obviously, too, that 311 in Chicago, people are able to request city services. So if someone notices the streetlights on their block are out, or if there's been graffiti, or if in these cold days there may be potholes, they want to report those and they want the city to take action on those, they can obviously report those at 311. And as well, 311 is the city's non-emergency police number. So every year we process about 20% of our Chicago Police Department's case reports right over the telephone at 311.
And you get how many calls a month?
Well, we just passed 4 million calls for the first time this past year in 2005. So that averages about 330,000 calls a month. Now, obviously, when summer comes and there's more activities and people are out and they're more active in their communities, the number of calls goes up. So in the summer months, we might see anywhere from 390,000 to 400,000 calls a month. And then in the winter months, it might taper off to 310,000, 320,000. But it averages out month over month to about 330,000 calls.
That's an overwhelming number of calls. How do you then take those calls and distribute the information, the request, et cetera, through City Hall?
what's critical is that system, that software, that enterprise software system behind 311. In the city, we have approximately 500 different types of city services, from stray animals to missing garbage carts to abandoned vehicles to potholes, open fire hydrants, and each of those 500 service requests are scripted. So that allows our operators to provide standardized information to the departments that are responsible for delivering those services. Those service requests then are routed electronically. So someone doesn't need to know how to navigate the bureaucracy. All they need to know is to call 311. We have a scripted intake. Our operators can ask a set of questions that have been prearranged by the departments. And then after we've completed the intake by clicking on the save icon, that request is routed electronically to the departments who are then responsible for delivering those services.
And how do you know, Ted, that the request has been responded to?
We have staff in 311. We have staff at the budget office. We have staff in the mayor's office that work at monitoring and analyzing all of the information. We don't want someone saying, well, you know, I called 311 about a pothole and it didn't really work. Or I called 311 about graffiti and it never came down. We want to be able to measure those responses. And so we have a core group of business analysts, of budget analysts, that spend their day monitoring the information in our system, working with the departments, analyzing their business processes, analyzing their use of the system to make sure that the services that people are requesting are getting delivered, and getting delivered in a timely manner, too, because that's very important to people.
311 technology, as you say, is designed to uncover patterns. Give me an idea of the kinds of patterns the system has discerned and how you've been able to act on that information at City Hall.
We have been able to detect certain patterns, and let me just give you a few examples that have really come to light in our experience at 311 in Chicago. One of the things that we noticed is that there are certain communities, certain neighborhoods, that have a higher incidence of graffiti than other neighborhoods. And by being able to monitor those addresses, those locations where graffiti seems to predominate, and providing reports to our local district police commander, we've been able to really reduce the incidence of graffiti in the city. Our Department of Streets and Sanitation is responsible for removing the graffiti, but if the graffiti continues to appear and reappear even after it's been removed, that generally can indicate a problem where there might be gang turf or there may be issues out in the neighborhood that, if left unattended, could foster crime. So we've got a partnership going between 311 and the police, the Department of Streets and Sanitation, where there are certain police surveillance strategies that are put into place to reduce those. Another trend that we noticed was in certain neighborhoods there was a greater number of fire hydrants that were being opened in the summer months. And by being able to track the number of calls for particular hydrants and work with our water management department, we were able to put custodial or locking caps on those fire hydrants that were being opened repeatedly, saving the city millions and millions of gallons of water. There's one other example. If this was something that was a surprise to us, frankly, and a pleasant surprise, we found, unfortunately, during the years that we were being plagued by West Nile virus, that there was a correlation between dead animals, dead birds, particularly blue jays and crows, and then the onset of West Nile in human cases. And by being able to track those reports of dead animals and then map geographically where they might have been, our city's Department of Public Health was able to implement prevention strategies that we think significantly reduced the incidence of West Nile among humans.
Do you know, Ted, how many cities are now using 311?
I don't have an exact number, but I can tell you that there are cities large and small that are using it, and the number is growing on a daily basis. It's obviously a tool that more and more mayors see as something that's very critical if they want to provide the most efficient and effective services to their people possible.
What stands in the way of other cities adopting such a system?
There may be budget constraints in certain cities where implementing the technology may stand in their way, at least on a temporary basis, or there may be issues with smaller cities where they might have trouble routing phone calls from particular addresses given the size of the jurisdiction that they're serving.
Ted, thanks for being with us on Smart City.
Thank you.
Ted O'Keefe is director of Chicago's 311 system. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Paul Levy is the founding executive director of Philadelphia's Center City District. Paul planned, received property owner and legislative approval for, and now directs the $14 million downtown management district. Paul also serves as executive director of the Central Philadelphia Development Corporation, an advocacy and planning organization supported by the downtown business community. Since 1979, Paul has taught in the Urban Studies and City Planning Department at the University of Pennsylvania. Paul, you've had a remarkable upsurge in residential and retail activity in downtown Philadelphia. What happened to turn things around?
I think we're seeing a lot of wonderful developments today that are the results of more than 15 years of work. It really began, I think, with the city and the business community coming together in the beginning of the 90s in the formation of the Center City District, then with the new mayor in 1991 with Mayor Rendell and a major priority placed on fiscal stability, then arts and entertainment, then investments in the convention center, all of that built on what had been a strong business and residential base. And so the more we began to see people coming into the city for arts and entertainment and for conventions, the more restaurants, the more cafes. And what that did is really create an environment where many more people who already worked downtown wanted to live downtown. And then we began to attract many people who would never live downtown who wanted to be in the middle of all the action.
Were there assets that predated the convention center, the arts and entertainment facilities, that you were able to leverage for the turnaround?
Yeah, I think there have been a number of things. I think, one, like many cities, Philadelphia is the beneficiary of almost 40 years of redevelopment efforts. This is a very walkable city that, from the 60s forward, placed a major emphasis on preserving historic buildings, even as we were building new buildings. And so we are today a city where more people than in any American city can walk to work in the downtown, and it's that walkability, I think, that was a huge strength. We also had a very strongly concentrated office district that was well served by public transit.
One of your strengths today seems to be a great restaurant culture, and that certainly permeates downtown and must be an asset for you. How did that develop?
That, too, has a sort of long genesis. This was a city that in the 1970s, the sidewalks rolled up at 5 o'clock at night. There were almost no restaurants in the downtown. There were a few sort of old-style clubs. And in the very late 70s and early 80s, there were a couple of pioneers who started doing restaurants within the downtown. And that was a good, strong, exciting base that lives through the 80s. But then when things really crystallized, when hospitality industry took off, when arts and entertainment took off, all of that happened on top of a strong business and residential base. And suddenly, with lots of people from outside the city, I think many more people were willing to take the risk on restaurants. And each time we had new restaurants open, I mean, we went from 60 restaurants in the downtown in 1990 to over 260 fine dining restaurants today. So it's been a huge and explosive growth over the last 15 years.
In your recent newsletter, Paul, you wrote, "Philadelphians are so unaccustomed to a healthy market, they don't recognize success when they see it. Has the skepticism made it more difficult for you to achieve progress?"
You know, I think every city has lived through hard times, so there is a kind of skepticism that many people feel anytime there's good news, they look for the bad news. And Philadelphia is like a lot of cities that has this sort of desire to criticize itself, and I think we've largely gotten over that. But even as we've had this hugely successful boom with very, very strong demographic trends that are driving it, people keep asking, well, who are going to fill up all these condos? And I think we've gotten out of the habit of recognizing that cities can be really attractive places. And I think all American cities are seeing this huge influx of young professionals, of empty nesters, and increasingly families.
Some people call you the mayor of downtown Philadelphia. Tell me about your organization and how it's funded.
First of all, I strongly shy away from any, I mean, I don't have to stand for election. People who run for office have to go through that very difficult process. So I would never term myself the mayor of the downtown. I run a business organization that works with residential organizations, and we cooperate very closely with any mayor. But we are a business improvement district. It's an organization that is funded by a mandatory assessment that's on all the downtown property. And this is something that the property owners themselves proposed back in 1990. They self-impose this assessment. And so today it gives us a budget of about $14 million a year, which we bill and collect directly from property owners. And so we have a direct business relationship with those owners. And we see ourselves in the business of providing a service to them, but also to make sure that Center City is as competitive as it can be.
And those services include?
Well, we started in 1991 with the absolute basics, clean and safe. I mean, we deploy over 70 people every single day on the sidewalks to remove litter, to remove graffiti, to pressure wash sidewalks. We deploy another 40 people to work in partnership with the police to improve public safety. And we could not have done anything in Philadelphia if we had not dealt with the basics. The city had a negative image. Sidewalks are now clean. Graffiti is now gone. We've cut crime in half. And this has been the experience of a lot of business improvement districts across the country. And so we see ourselves as supplementing but not replacing what the city does. And then we partner with the city on many, many efforts.
Obviously, business improvement districts, you said they've become popular throughout U.S. cities, and they work. Why do they work when City Hall doesn't?
I think one of the advantages that a business improvement district has, particularly in a downtown, is we assess the highest value real estate in the city. So it's unfair in some sense to compare us to a city that has to provide services, in our case, across 135 square miles, whereas my district is providing services across about 2 square miles. I happen to have about 25 to 28% of the assessed value of the whole district in the downtown. So we start, I think, secondly, and where I think business improvement districts do differentiate themselves from city government, is we are in the customer service business. If we don't provide the services that the property owners and businesses and residents want, they can put us out of business. That is, we're up for renewal periodically. And so we've built the culture into our organizations, as most business improvement districts, to make sure we're paying attention to the customer, we're annually doing surveys, we're constantly checking with people. And so we didn't just sit still with clean and safe. We soon began to market the downtown for retail, for restaurants, for residential. We've now done over $44 million of capital improvements in the downtown, adding new lighting, new signs, trees, all in response to a request from the customer that says you can't sit still. You've got to continually improve the product, the experience of the downtown, because the suburban shopping centers and the office campuses are not sitting still. They're always improving their product. We need to do the same thing.
How many people are living in downtown Philadelphia, Paul, and who are they?
It's a very interesting mix. Today, the residential population of Center City is 88,000. That places us third behind only New York City and Chicago in terms of downtown population. And a third of that population is young. It's 25 to 34 years of age, a very well-educated young population. 79% of the 25 to 34-year-olds have college degrees. So it's a young, well-educated group of people who are working in office buildings, who are working in healthcare institutions and in universities. There are also an increasing number of empty nesters, people whose children have gone off to college who are now choosing to come back to live in the downtown. They lived in the downtown in their 20s or 30s. Many of them moved to the suburbs and they're coming back. But increasingly, we're seeing people come in from New York City simply because they can no longer afford prices in New York City, and we're only 60 to 90 minutes away by train or by car from New York City. So we've got some advantages to play off of another city. And we're halfway between New York and Washington, D.C., so we do have people who are choosing to commute in both directions. But increasingly, we're getting families to stay in the downtown. We know we can go very far in revitalizing the downtown with young people as well as with empty nesters, but our true measure of success is when we can dramatically improve the schools and keep families with children living in the downtown and living in the entire city.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Paul Levy. He's president and CEO of the Center City District in Philadelphia. You have developed some specific strategies for providing the amenities that growing families look for in their neighborhoods. Tell me what you're doing on schools and parks in downtown Philadelphia.
Yeah, and candidly, I've been doing this for 15 years, and for 13 years, I very carefully avoided the schools issue because I did not think it was something that we could really succeed in stepping into. And Philadelphia has been through a very fortunate experience. About 4 years ago, there was a state takeover of our school district that put in place a new school reform commission, that put in place a new school board that was reform-minded, that has made dramatic improvements. And as part of the state takeover, there was a dramatic increase in funding for schools. We imported somebody from Chicago, Paul Vallis, who is the CEO of our school district now, and Paul, along with the chair, Jim Nevels, have been driving a process of dramatic change across the city. And like all urban school systems, over 80% of the children who are in the Philadelphia public school system come from families who are living at or below the poverty level. So it's a standard challenge. And they've done an extremely good job for disadvantaged families of improving opportunities and education. But where I think the unique partnership has been formed is our school district has recognized that they can place an equal emphasis on retaining and attracting middle-class families. You can do both with a school district. And so we began a partnership with the district that started with very simple things. We surveyed lots of parents of preschool-age children and asked them what they thought about schools, how they'd like to get information, what they knew. And not surprisingly, people in their 20s and 30s said the number one way they would like to get information about school choice was through websites. And yet not a single public school in the downtown, and we have 13 elementary public schools in our downtown, not a single one of them had a website. And so in partnership with those schools and the school district, we started building individual websites. We began a marketing campaign. We have reached out to daycare centers, pediatricians' offices, every place you could find young people with children, and have begun to market schools in conjunction with an improvement plan that has been both improving the curriculum in the schools that the school district is doing and focusing on what we're calling curb appeal. How does the school look from the outside? Does it have attractive playgrounds? Is it well lit at night? And so it's been a strategy first to simply market the schools as part of a choice, and we have good independent schools, we have good parochial schools, and we have good charter schools. And so it's part of a coordinated effort to simply say to parents, before you think about picking up and moving to the suburbs, consider the options in the downtown. Now, the school district has also created a new academic region that corresponds with an expanded version of what is the Center City area, and they're giving special priority to parents within that area to send their children to any number of the 13 elementary schools within the downtown. So it's marketing, it's enhanced choice, it's physical improvements. And that's been the first step, and we're about halfway through the first year of marketing, and we should have some really good results in within the next couple of months, in which the school district, I think, will be able to provide lots of new opportunities for parents in public schools. I think the other thing that becomes obvious is that the advantage of the suburbs with families with children are backyards and play areas, and if the city cannot provide playgrounds and recreational areas for young families or people in their 20s and 30s who are very interested in athletics, then we're not going to be competitive. And so we have started, and this is in a very early phase, but to evaluate all the recreational facilities within the downtown area to figure out what could be done to upgrade them, what are the minor things, again, just clean and safe and lighting can go a really long way. And so we're looking at those amenities and those things that are critical to maintaining families with children.
Paul, what hurdles did you run into in trying to carve out the downtown schools for, or the Center City schools, for special treatment?
Well, it's exactly the way you phrase that question that almost defines what the problem could have been, which is if in any city like Philadelphia where you have both affluent and middle-income areas and in areas that are in severe poverty, you can always run into conflicts if people feel that those who have resources are getting special treatment. And so what we've done with the school district is the notion of an academic region for the Center City area is being replicated across the entire city. So the school district is relooking at all its separate academic regions and is using the downtown as a pilot area to test the system of marketing and enhanced choice with the idea of spreading it elsewhere in the city. And I think we're very encouraged by that because that's exactly what happened with our downtown business improvement district. When we started in 1990, 1991, there were expressions of resentment. Well, why is the downtown able to do this and other areas are not? We made a commitment then, which we've honored, to help work with other areas, commercial areas in the city. There are now 8 other business improvement districts in Philadelphia. They're in low-income areas. They're in moderate-income areas. So we like to think about what we're doing with schools in Center City as a pilot, as a demonstration project, which can then be replicated elsewhere. And we're largely using the resources of the business community and foundations to test new ideas, which if they work, can then be spread across the city. We've done that with the police department. We've done that with other city departments. So I think one way business improvement districts or business organizations or universities can work with cities is to be test sites for new ideas, which the city might not want to do on its own. If they fail, you'd consider it a failure, but if they succeed, you learn how to replicate it across the entire city.
As you think about the expansion of these academic regions, is the Paul Levy of the next academic region to be found in the executive director of those bids you've helped stimulate, or do you see that person coming from another organization entirely?
I think that's a good question and a good challenge. And I mean, the same issue is getting posed with the University of Pennsylvania, which is the largest private employer in the city. And they've undertaken their own initiative in West Philadelphia to do dramatic improvements to the schools, to the surrounding communities. And unfortunately, there's only one University of Pennsylvania. You know, we have other universities, but no one with those resources. That's sort of the same situation with the Center City District. It's not my personality. It's the resources of a downtown organization, which are obviously significantly greater than in neighborhoods. And so I don't think it will be the business improvement districts, except in a couple of areas where they're working in partnerships. I think we're going to have to find new partners. I mean, one of the things that I found most exciting about the organization that you're involved with, CEOs for Cities, is it recognizes that you can't just look to government or you can't just look to business. Foundations have to play a role, universities and healthcare institutions. And I think in each different area of our cities, we have to evolve the type of partnerships that work where you have the strong actors or the strong players who can take the lead.
Is housing affordability an issue in Center City? You say that people are now actually commuting from New York because of the high housing prices in New York. So Philadelphia, I suppose, by comparison, looks cheap. Maybe the same thing is true about D.C., where housing seems like it's out the roof. But is that becoming an issue in Center City, Philadelphia, where as it is in so many cities?
It's interesting. It clearly has been raised as an issue here, but it has not reached the sort of extreme situation that it has reached in cities like San Francisco or Seattle or Boston or New York. And it goes to one of my sort of slightly silly theories about cities, but cities that are surrounded by water are both very vibrant and have really inflated housing markets. I mean, you take New York or you take Seattle or San Francisco, there's only limited room to expand. And so as demand increases, prices jump dramatically. Philadelphia has seen a dramatic appreciation, but our downtown blends right into middle-income and working-class and lower-income neighborhoods. And unfortunately or fortunately, we have thousands of vacant units still in our city. And so while inflation is an issue and affordability is an issue, what's happened is concentric rings have been spreading out from the downtown, and more people who can't afford the downtown are providing or finding more affordable opportunities 2 miles away, 3 miles away, or they're moving across the river to Camden. So I don't want to minimize the issue of affordability, but the advantage of Philadelphia in many ways is we're not landlocked, if you will, by water, and our markets are a little bit more fluid.
If you were given the job of redeveloping those blocks and blocks and blocks of empty units, many of which don't seem suitable to, I mean, just the stuff we have in our closets today. I mean, they're very small units. If that were your job instead of Center City, where would you start?
Well, I think Philadelphia, like a lot of cities, has had huge success. I mean, one of the great programs that came out of the Clinton administration, the Hope 6 projects, have led public housing, high-rise buildings that were really dysfunctional to be torn down, and really wonderful modern-style row houses in Philadelphia or twins to be built. So we've had huge success in modernizing public housing. You know, through the Community Development Block Grant Program, we've done a lot of successful renovation. We have nonprofit corporations that have done things. But housing isn't the end in itself. It clearly is the issue of jobs and people's ability to access those jobs. And so, and I actually did in the 80s work for the city's Office of Housing and Community Development. I think it's a very important issue. I think housing is a secondary issue. We've got to grow the economies of our cities, and we've got to make sure that people have the education and skills to participate in the economies that are growing. So I would continue to place the emphasis on job growth, on education and transportation as the ways to connect people. Then housing will take care of itself in that market.
Mm-hmm. Downtowns everywhere are experiencing a revival. Do you expect that trend to continue? Do you see anything that could reverse that trend?
You know, I think the macro trend here we can't lose sight of. In 1970, 70% of office space in regions across the country was in the downtown. Today, only 30% is across the country. So a great deal of market share has been lost by cities as work has decentralized. I think there are cities that are regaining their strength as office centers. I think cities are doing incredibly well with universities and hospitals, which really want to be in and around the center of regions. And those are huge employment centers. And I think so long as we continue to focus on the basics, clean and safe, quality public environment, quality schools, cities have enormous competitive advantages. And I think what we have going for ourselves now is, particularly with demographic trends, with a huge number of people who are becoming empty nesters, the baby boom, and with a huge wave of young people, there's a real interest in being in cities again. And I just like to think about the image of cities in movies of the 1970s, the Charles Bronson movies. Cities were terrible places you had to run away from. And then I think of the media images, whether it's in You've Got Mail or Sleepless in Seattle or TV shows like Sex and the City. I take these seriously in the sense that they show cities as wonderful, attractive places. TV series where women can walk alone on the streets at night. That's a huge cultural change that the image of cities have dramatically changed. So I think demographics, the cultural images of cities are aligning now with the employment opportunities. And after 50 years of losing market share, I think we've spent the last 10 years, and we could spend the next 40 years, really repositioning cities at the center of much more vibrant regions.
Paul, it's always great to talk to you. Thanks so much for being with us on Smart City.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Paul Levy is Executive Director of Philadelphia's Center City District. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Jordan Rappaport about the intertwined fates of cities and their suburbs. And we'll talk to Otis White about being face-to-face in an internet world. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, we were told that distance is dead, and yet the people who tried to sell us that notion were all out in Silicon Valley, sitting next door to one another, all having breakfast at the same place. And it seems that the recent transit strike in New York further puts to rest this notion that distance is dead.
It does, and certainly in some areas. The thing that was striking, the New York Times pointed this out after the transit strike, this is a terrible way to get to work. People were out there in that miserable cold weather walking to work, and while some of them simply had to walk to work, there are people in personal services like waiters and security guards and teachers and so on who, if they can't show up in person, can't deliver their services. An awful lot of them were office workers who you would think would be back in their nice warm apartment and doing their work through the phone lines. And yet thousands, maybe tens of thousands, of people who did not necessarily have to walk to work did so. So the question is, whatever happened to the telecommunications revolution that was going to make it so that people wouldn't drive to work anymore, they'd telecommute? And when the Times went in search of what explains this, they got some interesting answers. And one of them is that work is different, can be looked at in two different ways. First, there is some work that truly can be done from distance. You don't have to have human contact to do it. But an awful lot of the work that goes on in offices these days is relatively creative. And you need people to look each other in the eye as they're brainstorming and dealing with unusual problems and trying to come to consensus. And some of that work simply cannot be done from a long distance. So that seems to be the answer. Also, the meetings take on more importance these days because some work can be done through electronics, so that the meetings that do take place are more important and they need that human contact.
This reminds me of the conversations we had in banking when automated teller machines were just coming into being, and everyone thought that the ATM would replace the teller and would certainly replace checks. And, of course, lo, these many years later, we have ATMs, and tellers are still alive and well and serving us. So I think it seems that all of our ability to telecommute has, in fact, simply given us another option so that we can email from the beach and we're always in touch. But as you say, it doesn't eliminate the need to be face-to-face, and certainly watching those people in New York trudge to work in that cold weather made the point as graphically as it could ever be made.
Absolutely. Well, it's very hard to take the humanness out of human beings, so we sometimes just need to look each other in the eye.
Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
I'm Carol Collette, and you're listening to Smart City. Dr. Jordan Rappaport is senior economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. His many writings include the U.S. as a coastal nation and what are the benefits of hosting a professional sports team. His most recent research challenges the idea that cities and the suburbs are in competition with one another. Jordan, there's a popular notion that cities and their suburbs compete for residents, for jobs, for tax revenues. Is that a correct way to view their relationship?
First, let me note that what I say today represents my own views and not necessarily the view of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City or the Federal Reserve System. The notion that cities and suburbs are competing for jobs, residents, tax revenue, to be sure, there is an element of truth in that, but it misses the bigger picture. The bigger picture is that metro areas are really the entities that are competing for jobs, people, and revenue, and we see huge differences in metro area growth rates. You know, Pittsburgh has been relatively stagnant over the last 50 years, whereas you look at a place like San Jose that has just had huge growth, or Austin has had huge growth. And that really is much more important for Austin City and for the suburbs of Austin and for the city of Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh suburbs than any sort of growth at each other's expense within the metro area.
Why do you think, then, that this view of cities in competition with their suburbs persists?
I think it's because you can see it much more immediately. If you live within a metro area, you see the suburbs booming, and you see that the city is growing much slower. And, you know, you have to decide where are you going to live, the city or the suburbs. So I think it's a very immediate question that people face. The question of which metro area to live in is something that people face probably on a much less frequent basis. But in the end, across the country, across all people's choices, that's the more important element that's driving the growth.
What are the factors that influence the growth of metro areas, the growth of cities and the suburbs, thinking of them as one?
The first thing to understand is that there's huge mobility in the United States. If there weren't this mobility, if people basically, you know, you were born in a metro area and that's where you live, a firm was founded in a metro area and that's where it stayed, there really wouldn't be an issue of the metro areas growing at different rates. In the long term, a second big factor is the changing industrial composition of the United States. If you go back 50 years, heavy industry, steel and autos represented a huge share of employment in the United States. Today, they represent a much smaller share of employment, and so that opens up the possibility that their metro areas will grow at a slower rate. It actually doesn't guarantee that their metro areas are going to grow at a slower rate, because as heavy steel in Pittsburgh, let's say, became less important, it's still very possible that other industries could come to replace it. Similarly, New York has reinvented itself several times with different industries, or Los Angeles, with the decline of defense, was able to reinvent itself. But that changing industrial composition does open up the possibility of very different growth rates across metro areas. So still staying in the long term, air conditioning has been an incredibly important factor. Many of the Sun Belt cities have incredibly hot and humid summers. And so without air conditioning, you know, they probably would not have been attractive to the many people who've ended up moving there. And then the fourth really long-term important factor is the increasing importance of local amenities. So if you go back to the beginning of the 20th century, people were worried about clothing, shelter, food. And so thinking about, for instance, weather, thinking about if a place had nice weather, you just couldn't afford to be worried about that, to take that as a consideration in terms of where you live. But as we've become much wealthier over the 20th century, and one estimate is that per capita income has increased by a factor of 6 over the century, people could afford to think, hey, is this going to be a nice place to live? Does it have nice weather? Does it have good cultural amenities? Does it have good restaurants, a good nightlife, a sports team? So those are the factors in the long term that I think have led to the different metro area growth. If you think about in the short term, there are two sort of players here that matter. One is individuals have to choose, hey, you know, where do we want to live? And firms have to choose, where do we want to locate our facilities? And the two choices are interdependent because people don't want to move where there aren't jobs, and firms don't want to move where they can't hire good, high-quality people. But for firms, clearly they care about how productive can they be in a place. Regulations tend to make them less productive. So where is there a relatively light regulatory environment? Where are corporate taxes low? That's very important for firms. For some firms, it might be access to raw materials or access to, let's say, if you're shipping to the Far East, do you have access to port facilities or access to transportation facilities? But also for firms, again, this interdependence is where can they hire good people? For people, it's first of all, it's the jobs and where do they stand a good chance of getting a job. But also I think this idea of where are they going to have a good quality of life, by which I mean leaving aside the job for a second and leaving aside housing prices, where is just a nice place? I think Denver is a very good example of a metro area that has grown vigorously based on amenities. The Denver metro area has among the best weather in the United States. It has a relatively moderate winter, and it actually has a quite mild summer. And then you have the Rocky Mountains in your back door, and that makes it a very attractive place that a lot of people want to live. In turn, that has drawn a lot of firms to the Denver area because they know that they're able to attract high-quality talent. Whereas there's some other metro areas that, let's say, don't have some of these amenities, not either cultural or natural, and it's much harder for them to attract national talent. So I mentioned the jobs there, and the jobs, of course, go with wages. So where not only can you get a job, but how much will that job pay? A last factor, which is extremely important, is how expensive is housing.
You mentioned the ability of New York and Los Angeles to reinvent themselves as the industrial composition changed in America. What underlies the ability to reinvent a city?
I think that having very high human capital, by which I mean having very smart people there, regardless of what industry, and I think when you have this group of people with a very diverse skill base, particularly if they like where they live, if the industry in which they are working starts to decline, you know, these are people who can take their skills and move to a different industry. So I think that it's important to have these people with high human capital. And then also very helpful is if you have a diversified industrial base.
There has been a lot of conversation about regionalism. That's the new hot topic. And I'm trying to understand how regionalism, what strategies that suggests that are different than the strategies that have been pursued in the past. Let me ask you a question. Is there any reason you can think of not to focus on strengthening the city that anchors the metro region as the beginning point of a strong metro strategy or a strong regional strategy?
I think it is important to have a strong city at the center of a metro area. But I think if you were to start with that as your strategy, you know, you're right away setting up this paradigm of it's the city or the suburbs. I think you want to start with the idea that it's all of us. And so there's some things that just make sense to do in the city. If you're going to have a cultural district, let's say an orchestra and shows, particularly intensive area of restaurants, I think it's natural to have that in the city because that's an easy place for everyone to get to. You have to start from the recognition that this is something that doesn't just benefit people in the city, it benefits people throughout the whole metro area. And then you figure out what makes sense for us as a metro area. For some cultural amenities, the conclusion will be that they belong in the center. But for other amenities, it might make more sense to have them in the suburbs. We have a speedway here in Kansas City, Kansas, which, in the name notwithstanding, it's really located in a quite suburban area. And, you know, it just doesn't make sense to have a NASCAR speedway in the center. But it still contributes to the overall attractiveness of the Kansas City metro area.
You're listening to Smart City. We're talking with Jordan Rappaport. He's author of The Shared Fortunes of Cities and Suburbs, a review that appeared in the Economic Review, third quarter 2005, and he's senior economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. Take the city of Detroit, and Explain to me the relationship there between the city and its suburbs. Not that you've looked at Detroit and Wayne County in detail, but I want to understand better this synergy that you say is there in terms of the fortunes of city and suburbs moving in parallel.
If we look at the period 1970 to 2000, so the Detroit suburbs grew at approximately 5% per decade over that period, and the city shrank at approximately 15% per decade. So it is true that in Detroit, the suburbs grew quicker than the city. But if you compare the Detroit suburban growth to average suburban growth, it's way, way below. And so although the Detroit suburbs grew and the Detroit city shrank, if the Detroit metro area had been a place that was more vigorously attracting firms and individuals, both could have expected to have grown, firstly, the city could have expected to grow rather than decline in terms of its population, and the suburbs would have experienced much more vigorous growth. So if you live in the Detroit metro area, let's say you live in a suburb, you don't necessarily work in the suburb. You're going to work somewhere in the metro area. Similarly, although it's less common, you have people living in the city working in the suburb. What matters here is Detroit's ability to attract firms and individuals.
As we talk about regionalism, as we think about cities and suburbs beginning to realize that their fates are moving in tandem and that they need to be making decisions jointly that will benefit the whole rather than any individual piece, Denver comes to mind as a city and a region that is building a track record of regional decision-making, first around the regional tax that funded a number of amenities there, and more recently, the tax that the communities within the metro area put on themselves to fund new transit. I'm curious if you're seeing that example replicated in other places.
I think you're right in pointing to Denver as a great example of how metro area coordination can work. You know, as you say, they have a cultural, the specific term is a scientific and cultural facilities district, and this spans all or parts of seven counties. It was created all the way back in 1988, and it's been funded by a tenth of a cent retail sales tax that extends throughout these seven counties. And in 2003, it raised $35 million in tax revenue. And then it distributed that to a number of different organizations, four organizations, the Art Museum, the Botanic Gardens, the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, and the Denver Zoo got approximately 60% of the funding that was raised. Another 30% of the funding went to a number of organizations that could show that they appealed throughout the metro area. And the remainder of the funds, a little over 10%, was then used within each of the local communities to fund community activities. So, as you say, they got together, they enacted this tax, it's been renewed by voters two or three times, and what's great about it is the whole metro area got together and funded things that benefited people throughout the metro area. In fact, not many metro areas have followed this model. It's really a handful.
Jordan, thanks so much for being with us on Smart City.
Carol, thank you for inviting me.
Jordan Rappaport is senior economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. You're listening to Smart City. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says you may want to take those predictions with a grain of salt.
I used to solve the New York Times crossword puzzle every day. Each morning, I would look forward to finding the puzzle and working my way through the clues. Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays were my favorites because those puzzles were hard enough to absorb me, yet not too hard to frustrate me. I always needed help on Saturdays, but I had the weekend, so I was happy to take my time. Whenever I missed the daily crossword because of vacations or travel, I would catch up upon my return. This meant doing a few puzzles a day, but I wasn't satisfied until I had caught up by working through each one in order. Then I could get back to my daily routine of solving that day's puzzle. Catching up with the New York Times crossword puzzles often turned into a real job, though, because some of my trips were pretty lengthy. But I was determined not to let a single puzzle go unsolved, so I would dutifully set out to catch up whatever it took. Keeping current was that important to me. One year, though, my commitment became too much to sustain. I was gone for a month on a Grand Canyon trip and then came home to work deadlines that required my full-time attention. The pile of unsolved puzzles got bigger each day because I couldn't keep up. I was so busy catching up with work that days would pass before I could tackle another puzzle or two. I couldn't enjoy the current day's puzzle because I was working on one from a few weeks prior. And the more I fell behind, the edgier I became about it. I started stealing away at odd moments and late nights to fill out a corner or stare at a half-finished answer. But that wasn't enough. It became clear that the only way for me to catch up was for crossword puzzles to take priority over everything else in my life. After weeks of worry, I awoke one morning to the realization that my passion for crosswords had become an obsession. And how stupid was that? Caught in the grip of a compulsion to continue my unbroken streak of never missing a New York Times crossword puzzle, even to the point of scrimping on time for other things in order to finish them. So I gave up the New York Times crossword cold turkey. I tossed out my stack of unsolved puzzles, and I quit trying to do one every day. Only occasionally, when I'm looking for a distraction, will I pick one up. Not that there's anything wrong with them. There's just something bad about how I handle them, which has become my new measure of temperance and suitability. We should be entrusted with nothing but what we can handle without diminishing or destroying ourselves. And if we're really honest about our capacities for discipline and control, that's a standard that would separate us from a lot of things we do, big and small. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, sign up for podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music provided by Christopher Reyes. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.